Keep up to date on the details of the biggest court cases happening in Australia. The Case Law Podcast is your eyes and ears inside the courtroom. Join me, Stephen Stockwell, as I unpack the biggest trials and share the details behind the headlines with the ABC's best court reporters. We explain how the law works and answer your crime and legal questions along the way. Search the Case Law Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey ladies, this episode covers some heavy content and there's mention of suicide. Please know that help is available and we'll link to some resources in the show notes.
Felt like I'd fallen down a really narrow, long, long well, and I knew that there was light at the top of it, but I couldn't really see it. You can know logically what you need to do to get yourself out of a hole, right? And I knew that logically, but I could not do it.
Julie Goodwin is a cook, an author, a presenter, and a mum. You probably know her face from her 2009 MasterChef win. 4 million people watched as Julie and Po Ling Yeo went head-to-head in the final episode of MasterChef, and she became a household name. But Julie's time on the show was fraught. Yes, it was stressful anyway, but she had limited contact with her family and support system, and while she expertly trusted chicken on our screens, inside, she was drowning. Julie had become an expert in hiding things from almost everyone around her. Her feelings of inadequacy, her excessive drinking, and her panic attacks.
Sometimes it just comes out of a clear blue sky and it's just a physical response, right?
Being squeezed in the pressure cooker environment of a smash hit TV show was not the first time she'd experienced mental ill health, and it wouldn't be the last. She had to wade through a lot of shit to get to the other side. I'm Yumi Steins. Ladies, we need to talk about the recipe for resilience with Julie Goodwin. Julie was born in the 70s, an era where serious stigma around mental health was standard.
We didn't talk about it as an everyday thing. And, you know, my mum and dad and my nan came from times of war and depression and all that sort of stuff where you had to just get on with it, you know. And so to sort of say I'm struggling a bit at the moment, it just wasn't done.
Those were the days of keeping your chin up, putting your best foot forward, and burying your feelings deep.
We've got so many expressions for how you're meant to be, how to be resilient, how to be strong, how to be reliable, how to be all the things that everyone around you needs you to be. And there was no language whatsoever for, I don't think I'm coping.
And Julie wasn't coping. When she was 3 years old, her dad left. Her mum tried to compensate for his absence, but Julie wasn't able to get past the feeling that him leaving was somehow her fault.
Even as a toddler, you internalise that and wonder what it is about me that made me able to be left. You know, my feeling as a little person, I had to kind of try and hold my family together. It was my job to hold my family together and, you know, to keep everybody happy. That's a lot of stress for a child to have.
It wasn't just home where Julie was under stress.
I was a high achiever. I did very well at school. I suppose it's how I'd made myself as lovable as I could make myself, and that made me as safe as I could make myself.
Julie learned to be all the things that everyone around her needed her to be, a good girl who always followed the rules and excelled in school.
You know, no one will leave me if I'm this shiny, high-achieving little person.
You describe yourself as a list maker, a diary keeper, and a planner. Would you also describe yourself as a perfectionist?
Yeah. It's only been in recent years that I've come to understand what that really means. I would never have described myself as that because it sounds like you're saying I am perfect. But what it really means is that I'm trying really hard to be perfect. And sometimes that means I'll work so hard to make things perfect that I wear myself out. And other times it means I'm too frozen to begin because I know it won't be perfect. So it's actually a really crippling way to be.
When Julie was 18, she met the love of her life, Mick. 6 years later, they married and they had three little boys, one after the other, three under three, which is a lot. The perfectionism that had defined her childhood stayed with her and meant that the parenting stakes were sky high.
I was so desperate to get it right, you know. It was so weird to me that someone left me in charge of these completely helpless human beings. No qualifications, no experience. I really forced myself to do everything to the nth degree. And I'll never forget, I used to hang their little singlets. I had three under three. I'd hang their little singlets on the clothesline in size order. And then I had to make sure that the pegs matched the colours of the clothing. And there was some kind of fear that someone was going to land on my doorstep and judge me on whether or not the cot sheets were ironed or their little pillowcases were ironed or whether the towels were all folded with the selvages at one end and placed properly in the linen closet and that the taps had been scrubbed with a toothbrush. It was a lot.
But between the loads of washing, Julie had ambitions. She and Mick had been watching MasterChef UK on the telly, and when it was announced that there would be an Australian version, Julie wanted in. But being the first ever season, there was a lot she didn't know when she went for it.
People used to say, well, you signed up for it. And I was like, no, I had no idea. Literally didn't know I would have to live out of home when I signed up. I literally did not know that I would have my phone and my computer taken away from me. You know, when I signed on, I thought I was signing on to the British-esque version of it where it was quite short. They went home at night. I didn't find out until I was in like the top 40 of the country that I would have to live out of home to compete in this competition.
In MasterChef Australia, there would be no home visits and limited contact with friends and family. But by this stage, she'd beaten 56 people on the show to make it into the top 40, and she couldn't back out now.
I remember the phone conversation with Mitch going, I told us something today, but I'm not quite sure how this is going to go. And we decided we'd just continue with it, but I didn't know that that's what it was going to be. I jumped into this situation that was tremendously stressful and I was only allowed to phone home a couple of times a week and it placed a lot of stress on all the contestants, and that was the goal.
Beyond desperately missing her family, Julie didn't realise just how rigorous the judging would be and how that feedback would make her feel.
It becomes obvious that people really are critiquing every tiny little thing, including how many of something you put on a plate and where you place it on a plate.
Julie was used to being the best at things and being praised for it. But here she was having that core belief tested on national television.
I think that that MasterChef experience played into my perfectionism more than anything I ever had.
Like she had in high school, Julie ignored the anxious feelings when they rose up. She focused instead on being perfect, and it carried her all the way through to the finals.
And I remember saying it to Poe when it was just the two of us left in those last few days. I feel like I'm underwater. I can't quite hear anything properly, and I can't quite breathe properly. And I literally felt like I was in a tank full of water. I was having a physical response. And at the end of MasterChef, living on adrenaline for 5 months is so bad for you, you know. And so that adrenaline leaving my body, that had a profound impact.
MasterChef was over, but everyone wanted a piece of Julie. The weeks after her win were filled with meetings, radio appearances, photo shoots, live events, and Julie didn't have any time to acknowledge the cloud of depression that was taking over her brain.
There were deadlines for magazines. There was, you know, scripts that had to be written, travel that had to be done, endorsements that had to be done. I was on the deadline for photo shoots and filming and interviews. My God. Come Easter, Christmas, Mother's Day, Father's Day, I had to do all this radio around, you know, how to roast the perfect turkey. It was relentless. And my poor family, there were no slots in there for them.
Mick and Julie's boys took a back seat to Julie's schedule, as did her mental health.
Becky Radio, you can't have an off day. You can't go in and go, I'm having a bit of a blue day, so just leave me alone for a minute. You're going to be on. And so some days I would leave the radio station, I would feel, like physically feel my face, like a mask stuck in this position, and I would have to try and release those muscles to let it come down. And there were days where I just could not face another human being, you know, and I'd have to go off and be by myself. And some of those days were extremely dark.
Julie started experiencing panic attacks. With no warning, she would start shaking, sweating, her heart would hammer inside her chest, and it could happen at any time, while she was driving, when she was getting ready to teach a class.
Sometimes I'd be in the middle of that right as all my students would come into my cooking school to do a cooking class. I could hear everyone coming in, my staff bringing them in. They'd all be chatting, really excited. They'd be sitting down to have, you know, snacks before the class started, getting their aprons on. And I'd be in the office with the door shut between us, with my head on the desk, just hyperventilating and just thinking, I've got to go out.
Julie's hubby Mick was aware that something was going on, and together they'd try to work it out, try to find a way to avoid the next panic attack. But it was hard to pinpoint the exact triggers.
And sometimes there's just no answer to that. Sometimes it just comes out of a clear blue sky and it's just a physical response, right? And we can't always control that lizard brain. If something kicks you in the lizard brain, it shoots that adrenaline out, you know, sometimes a comment on social media or something like that. I don't really care what online trolls think of me, but occasionally one will pierce that armour and release that flood of adrenaline.
Julie was trying to hold it all together and to cope with the pressure, she started to self-medicate. And her medicine of choice was alcohol.
I started leaning on it more and more heavily. And as my mental health declined and I needed to shut down at the end of a day where I'd, you know, been up at 4:30, done my radio show, gone to the cooking school, run a class, got home, could not shut the head down. And that's what I used to shut my head down and go to sleep.
Julie didn't believe her drinking was a problem because she thought she was still in control.
I decided to make a rule where I wasn't going to drink on school nights because it was too hard to get up in the morning. And because I was able to make that rule for myself and stick to that rule for myself, I felt I didn't have a problem, but I made up for it on the weekends. And then, you know, COVID hit, the world shut down, and none of those restrictions applied anymore. And I don't think I'm alone when I say it all hit a bit harder then.
Did the drinking make the anxiety worse?
100%. Physiologically, it's just a fact, right? It stuffs up your sleep, which I now know is one of the most important things for mental health. It's one of the first things that needs to be addressed. But adding alcohol into that mix, I would wake up with my heart pounding.
Julie was stuck in a cycle where she would drink to deal with the anxiety, but when she drank, her anxiety would get worse. And then it started to cause problems in her marriage.
It was hurtful to Nick that I would rather spend the night with a bottle of wine than with him, you know? He kept expressing his worry and I kept brushing it off like it wasn't important and telling him that he was overreacting and that the problem was his and his perception, not mine and my behaviour. You know, so that's starting to damage a marriage, right?
Beyond her relationship with Mick, Julie started to see herself as a problem for the people around her.
I just felt like my inability to be happy was detrimental to my children. I'd raised them to always look at the positive side. And I'd raised them to be strong and capable, and I felt none of those things. I felt no joy. I felt no strength. I felt no resilience. I felt no ability to look forward. And so I thought, by my very existence, I was creating a terrible example for them. It just felt logical to me that my presence was harmful to them. It was holding them back from living happy lives. Causing worry for the people I love was a terrible thing for me to do, and that I just had to just get out of the picture. I'd raised my sons. I'd done my job. It was time for me to let them go.
One evening, Julie went down to the beach with no intention of returning.
I had decided that I was going to do what I considered to be the best thing I could possibly do for my family. I didn't want to say goodbye, but I felt like I had to, you know. I felt like that was actually the selfless thing to do. Once you get to that point, That's the only thing that makes sense. You know, it seems like the right thing to do. It seems like the fair thing to do. It seems like the selfless thing to do. And that's just incorrect. It felt like I'd fallen down a really narrow, long, long well. And I knew that there was light at the top of it, but I couldn't really see it. You can know logically what you need to do to get yourself out of a hole, right? I knew that logically, but I could not do it. I couldn't find a handhold. I couldn't find a foothold.
A couple walking on the beach that night stopped to check on a clearly distressed Julie. They talked with her and then continued on their walk. But concerned for her well-being, this amazing duo doubled back to check on her again and stayed with her to make sure she called her husband, Mick.
Mick, when he found out what had happened that night, he took me straight to the hospital. I was put under the care of the acute mental health team. They said, you need to go into a psychiatric unit. And I laughed. I'm just like, oh, no. I'm back on the radio in a few days and I've got these people coming from America to do a cooking class in my cooking school. So next suggestion. And they're like, no, this is what we think needs to happen. And I remember turning to Mick to sort of, you know, nudge, nudge, these jokers talking about. And he was just white. And I just went, babe. And he said, it sounds right to me.
Julie was admitted into hospital that same night.
I felt like I'd fallen through the looking glass, you know. It shocked the shit out of me. And I held a lot of incorrect perceptions of what a psychiatric hospital is. And I held a lot of judgment about it. And I held a lot of shame about it. And after 6 weeks in there, I'd lost a lot of those things and I'd learned a lot of things. And I came out with some tools. I came out with some more damage. Like, they're not all fun and games, but there's certainly a lot to be said for handing yourself over. And that's what I decided to do.
It has been 6 years since that night on the beach.
I was in hospital 5 times in a whole lot of different places. 4 of them psych wards, 1 of them a rehab. You know, that was the last piece I knew had to happen in the puzzle. Should have been the first piece, but, you know, we've got to come to it as we can, don't we? You know, the teacher arrives when the student's ready.
It was during her stint in rehab that Julie recognised she had to stop drinking.
For someone like me, there's nothing good about drinking. So it took a couple of years and I still have to be aware. I still go to a psych. I have maintenance sort of sessions of once a month. I still have to keep a handle on my workload and that sort of thing.
Speaking in front of big crowds of people is a particular trigger.
There's nothing unnatural about that, actually. I think it's actually appropriate. But what I've got to do is assess the cost benefit. Is it worth it to me to go through that for the outcome of doing this event or being in that room full of people?
Julie's learnt that she doesn't have to say yes to everything, that there is room for a day off. But when she does say yes, she needs to be ready for any heightened feelings that might come her way.
Quite often it is worth it, but I've just got to say I need to allow for that feeling, I need to prepare for that feeling, and I need to recover from that event. So I've got to build in recovery time as well. I do want to keep putting myself out there. I do want to keep doing hard things. If I chose to live a life where I don't invite any anxiety in, then I feel like it would be a smaller life than what I have.
Julie, I'm getting a lot from you in this conversation today about how to manage anxiety and depression. Some of the pillars are good sleep, being sober. Am I right in saying that exercise has been one of the pillars for you as well?
Yes, it is. It is. Exercise has been really important and it's so boring, Yumi. God. So boring to say that and nobody wants to hear it because we all kind of know, don't we, right? But for me, it's been about finding what I like. I love nature, but I don't like walking. I'm not someone who goes, oh, let's go for a nice walk. Mick loves walking. He would walk anywhere. So if it's further than the driveway, I'll drive things. But I love to swim and I actually, and I apologise if I can hear myself, I've come to really enjoy going to the gym. And, you know, my husband, Mick, and I made a commitment to each other that we're going to do what we need to do to live as long as we can. And I've learned that not only for my mental health, but for my longevity and for my well-being now, you've just got to move your body. And so I would say if you hate exercise and it makes you want to curl up under your doona, God, I've so been there. Just there's going to be something. If it's catching Pokemon, go catch Pokemon. You know, if it is dancing, then go out and dance. It doesn't have to be at the nightclub with six cocktails. Put some leg warmers on and play some 70s music. Whatever. Just find something that makes you a bit excited. There's going to be something that you enjoy doing, but that's what I enjoy doing. And I don't find it hard to do anymore. And I actually get a bit itchy if I've been a while without it.
You dedicate your book to Mick and your beautiful love story. It sounds like he has been a huge part of helping you through the darker times.
I wouldn't be here. It's really quite straightforward. And we've been together since we were teenagers. So it's been 36 years since we started going out, and we've been married for 30 of those years. And I am a very, very lucky human being. And I would just say that if you've got someone like that in your life, just love them as hard as you can and let them love you back. And if you don't have a partner like that in your life, seek that kind of love among your friends, among your other family members, even among your colleagues. You know, there is support, there is care, there is love. There are groups. I'm such a believer that isolation is one of the biggest issues that we face. I guess it's my mission to bring people together.
It's through food that Julie gathers people together, and she reckons all of us need to find our people. And sometimes you need to go past the usual friends and family.
And it is possible to be isolated even when you're surrounded, to find the people that you can really truly connect with. If anxiety is a big problem, find a group of people who are also working their way through that, you know, and maybe learn how to talk to it. Oh, hello, darkness, my old friend. Hi, anxiety. You sneaky little bugger. You've wormed your way in today, haven't you? Let's have a chat about that. You know, once you can see something and name it, it's no longer the monster under the bed, you know. It's the little fuzzy with the googly eyes that you can sit down next to you and give a little hug to it. I know why you're here. You're trying to protect me. But let's talk through this. We don't need your protection right now.
It has been so good to talk to you. I have loved your advice, and I've loved the vigour with which you seem to be bringing into your life right now as a sober, less anxious person, Julie Goodwin.
Oh, look, thank you. And I have to say, and I don't even know if you would remember this, but some years ago, and it was prior to all of this happening, prior to me falling right off my perch, I reached out to you because you had spoken about the drinking, and I reached out to you and you were so incredibly kind to me. And whilst I wasn't ready at that point, your words stayed with me and helped me through when I was ready.
Now I'm going to cry, Julie. That's really kind.
Well, your words matter, and the things that you do matter, and this podcast matters. And I think talking openly and without shame matters.
I agree. Take care.
Thank you so much.
So much love.
See you, mate.
Bye.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Gundungurra, Gadigal and Muwinina peoples. Ladies We Need to Talk is mixed by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, produced by Elsa Silberstein and Sarah Mashman. Supervising producer is Tamar Cranswick, and our executive producer is Alex Lolbach. This series was created by Claudine Ryan.